This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Earlier this year, a major survey found that airline passengers in the U.S. are more dissatisfied than they were last year. And the U.S. Transportation Department just announced that consumer complaints about airlines have nearly doubled since last year. From rising fares to shrinking legroom to risk of delays and cancellations, the experience of booking and taking a flight can range from inconvenient to outright miserable. Our next guest says it doesn't have to be that way. In his new book, he looks at how we got here when it comes to airline policy. He says there are a lot of changes that would improve things. You could join in at 800-642-1234. If you've taken a flight recently, what was your experience like? Did the major flight cancellations late last year affect your holiday plans and maybe the plans you're making this year? Do you have a smaller airport in your community that's seen reduced service or now no service at all? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Ganesh Sitaraman is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University, director of the Vanderbilt Policy Accelerator. His new book is called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. Ganesh, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks so much for having me.
Before we get into the policy story you tell in your book, miserable? I mean, people might think, I don't love flying, but is it really that bad?
I think it really is. And it's bad for both passengers and it's bad for the country. You know, for passengers, we all deal with the complicated number of fare classes and extra fees when checking a bag or picking your seat. Then there's the shrinking legroom that we've seen over the decades, plus the fact that you rarely get food or anything on planes anymore. And when you look more broadly to the country, there are also real problems in the airline industry. Delays, cancellations, having to connect through big cities all the time instead of being able to take nonstop flights, and the boom and bust cycle that we've been in, where in some years airlines are doing really well, but then when there's a big crisis, they need a taxpayer bailout or support program. And I think that shows the fragility of the industry and the fact that we're not getting the best quality service. So the combination of those two things, yeah, I do think flying is miserable.
I want to take us to a turning point you describe in the book where we'd had a system of federal regulation, at least of interstate airlines and flights, and then we deregulated very quickly. Can you paint us a picture of what, Ganesh, things looked like before that deregulation? How did our airline system work?
Yeah, from the 1930s to the 1970s, there was a system that I think of as a stable, reliable system. And Congress in the 1930s decided that they wanted the airline system to be able to serve the whole country, including small places, small towns. And we have a really big country. And so they wanted to make sure every part of the country had access to air service. They also wanted an airline industry that was going to be stable and reliable, one that didn't need tons of subsidies, wasn't going to face a lot of bankruptcies or bailouts. And so they tried to have a system of regulated competition in which there was some competition, but not so much that airlines would go under, and also not so little that there would be a monopolist or just a few airlines that were dominant. And the way they achieved that system was by having a federal regulator allocate routes to the different airlines, so each airline would be assigned to where they were going to fly, and set prices also that were just and reasonable for consumers. And during this period of about 40 years, we saw expanded number of people, passengers flying. We saw prices going down. And there were big innovations like the jet age starting up, the move from propeller planes to jets that we have now, and also competition on service quality. And so that was this stable period. And it was one in which members of Congress and policymakers really said that this is a transportation infrastructure that is critical to our society, and we need to regulate it more like a public utility, something that's essential to a lot of different communities and individuals.
Then here comes this deregulation urge. People from Ralph Nader and Senator Ted Kennedy to very conservative economists at the University of Chicago united in this idea that deregulation is going to make things even better. What were the promises? And your whole book is mainly saying these promises didn't come true, but what was the case that they made?
Well, the advocates for deregulation in the 70s, they looked at the regulated competition model and said, this looks like a cartel, and cartels are bad. We should have competition. And they thought that if we just let airlines fly wherever they want, whenever they want, and to charge whatever they want, that we'd have a much better system. There would be dozens of airlines flying around efficiently. One person even suggested up to 200 airlines would be efficiently operating, and that there wouldn't really be any downsides, not in quality of service or loss to cities. And that was a pretty good pitch. Congress bought the pitch and deregulated the airlines in the 1970s, in 1978 specifically, under Jimmy Carter. And as I argue in the book, we didn't really get what they were promising, ultimately. We ended up, instead of in that dream world, in something more like the Hunger Games, where in the early 80s, you saw really cutthroat competition between new upstarts who were serving high volume routes and offering low prices with no frills and no unionized workers. But then the big airlines fought back, and they would undercut them in price and push them out of those routes. And over the course of the 80s, there were dozens of bankruptcies and mergers, and we actually ended up with consolidation once again, low competition, and the same big airlines that were running the show in the 70s were running it by the end of the 80s. Just this time, they were unregulated instead of regulated.
Ganesh Sitaraman is with us talking about his new book, Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Ganesh, before we go to our callers, one big consequence you highlight in the book, and one that gave some members of Congress who supported deregulation buyer's remorse, is that a lot of small and even mid-sized cities saw declines in the amount of service they got, or even airports no longer served by passenger air. What happened?
This is a really important point, that under the regulated system, because the regulators allocated routes, airlines were required to serve some places that weren't always going to have a lot of volume of people flying there. But we understood that it was important for them to have access to air travel. And they would also get to serve some places that were going to have a lot of traffic. When deregulation happened, there was no obligation to serve those places anymore. And so airlines could cut back on the places that had lower volumes and invest more in the places with higher volumes. And so we saw this reshaping of the geography of air travel that in many ways over the last four decades has harmed smaller cities, smaller communities, rural places. And exactly as you said, you know, even in the as early as the 1980s, there were members of Congress regretting their votes. I talk in the book about Robert Byrd, the senator from West Virginia, who apologized for his vote and wished he could go back and re-regulate the airlines because of the devastating effects it had had on his community and so many other small communities and states.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Vicki is with us in Mequon. Vicki, hello.
Hi there. And if I could preface my comment about a recent flight I took with, I was a Pan Am flight attendant. If you remember, Pan Am World mm-hmm. Airways was the premier airline, and I took pride for 10 years serving passengers in economy on 14-hour flights. People got off, and they were happy. I just took a flight from Chicago to Rome on American. It was an Airbus A320. There's no room for your butt. There's no room for your feet. There's no room for your elbows. I couldn't even reach down to try to get my book out from under the seat in front of me. You have movies and you have other things. I think passengers would be much happier with space.
Vicki, thanks a lot for sharing that. Before and after, Ganesh, can you talk about some of the changes that led to what Vicki saw as a transatlantic flight attendant and now as an air traveler in a much smaller seat?
Well, thanks, Vicki, for sharing your story. And I think it's just all too common for all of us that we've seen over the last few decades seats shrinking. And it's not a perception. They actually have shrunk in size over the years. And that's a real problem for exactly the reasons you say. It's gotten a lot less convenient for passengers, and it causes people to be more frustrated. And often, you know, sometimes they'll take that out on people like you who were flight attendants and who are really doing their best to provide good quality service to everyone on the airplanes. And so I think this is really a core part of the story, that if the airlines are competing in a way that is just to get more people in and make more money that way, rather than providing a good quality service, you know, of course, if there's no competition, they're going to, you know, jam us in as much as they can with the smallest seats that they can. And that's where we are now, because if you want to go from Chicago to Rome, well, how else are you going to get there? You can't swim, and it'll take too long to drive and then take a ship. We really need airlines. And when we have few choices, there's little we can do.
Vicky, thanks for that call. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us, professor of law at Vanderbilt University. His new book is called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Do you agree that air travel has gotten worse over time, whether you're looking at that as a passenger or someone who works in the industry? Would you want to see a change in the way airlines are regulated? Do you have questions for our guest? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with Vanderbilt Law Professor Ganesh Sitaraman about his new book, Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It, which proposes airline policy solutions aimed at improving the air travel experience. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the industry, your experiences as a passenger, pilot, mechanic, steward, you name it. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Back to your calls now. Bill is with us in Madison. Bill, hi.
Hey, how's it going, Rob? I think your guest has a pretty solid handle on what's going on in the industry, and I'm looking forward to reading his book. So I'm kind of in between those categories. My best friend is a flight attendant, so I've gotten to hear a lot of stories from the inside of what's going on there. First, I'd like to say that flight attendants are there for your safety first, and that's their primary job. And the drinks and other things that come along with that are secondary and are just nice to have. That's not their primary function. And the other thing I was wondering if folks knew is that most flight attendants who work in the commercial aviation industry get their schedules as a result of a competitive bidding process, which is largely based on seniority.
Bill, thanks for the call. Ganesh, I don't know if you want to get into the intricacies of how flight attendants work, but you'd spend a lot of time talking about the impact of deregulation on the people who work for airlines.
Yeah, and it's a really important part of the story. You know, to be a pilot, a flight attendant, a mechanic actually requires a great deal of skill and talent. And we should value that because, as the caller said, you know, there's the real importance of safety in this industry that we all understand and I think take very seriously. But what happened after deregulation was, in the quest to cut costs in order to operate in a competitive system, you actually saw airlines, big and small, working to reduce pay, reduce benefits for their employees. And this led to a lot of conflict between labor and management in the 1980s. And even Senator Ted Kennedy from Massachusetts, who was one of the biggest proponents of airline deregulation in the 70s, by the end of the 80s, was fuming over how upset workers in the industry were at what had happened. And, you know, he said this isn't what was promised to him about what was going to happen after deregulation with the changes for people who work in the industry. And so, you know, today, I think one of the most important things is thinking about how do we ensure that we have a set of people who work in this industry who are really valued and are paid well for the work that they do, because it is essential to keeping us safe when we fly.
Thanks for that call, Bill. Mary joins us now in Fitchburg. Mary, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. And I appreciate that you guys are talking about this today.
What did you want to bring up?
Well, I am, I, from the hometown of Delta, where Delta started in Louisiana. And I always find it really ironic that we, you know, they started there, but it is so expensive to get home and to find a reasonable flight, especially with two kids and one of them very small, that are at decent times of the day that are below $800 for a round trip ticket. It's so, just almost impossible to get home with those prices.
So what do you end up doing, Mary? Just not going home, or do you fly sort of near as you can and drive over? What, how have you tackled that?
It's a combination. I mean, we search for whatever is most economical. I have made many 14 to 16 hour trips home in a car. Mm-hmm. But I have an infant now, so it's just not super reasonable. So the last time I flew, I was getting home close to midnight with, you know, my two kids. So it was just, it's unfortunate, but we do our best, but it's just so hard to get home because of those types of pricing.
Mary, thanks a lot for that call. This is super common. You write, Ganesh, even when smaller communities, or, you know, what we think of like as medium, even sized communities, have that air service, it's often hub based. It's often, as Mary finds, very expensive to get from point A to point B.
This is one of the real problems that's happened, is we've had this consolidation in the airline industry, which is really efficient and cost savings for the airlines. You know, if every city connects through Atlanta, in the case of Delta, they run a big operation in Atlanta, but they don't have to provide nonstop service between two cities. They make you connect. But the other problem that happens is if you're a smaller city and you don't have a lot of competition, they're really the only game in town. And so the combination of those two things means higher prices, more inconvenience, and it's just harder to get places in a more affordable way. And that's where we are today because of the deregulatory system that left us in a place where the airlines get to pick where they want to fly and how much they're going to charge.
Thanks for sharing that experience, Mary. Ganesh Sitaraman is with us. His new book is called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. Back to your calls. KC is with us here in Wisconsin. KC, hello.
Hey, good afternoon.
What did you want to tell us about?
Well, I think the main thing right now that's frustrating me more than anything is the rampant violence that's going on in commercial flights these days, and everybody is asking, why is this so prevalent? Why is this happening so often? And to me, I've been a frequent flyer for going on my 40th year, and by a frequent flyer, I mean virtually every week for a minimum of four flights a week. But the reason for all the violence on airlines these days is, to me, pretty obvious. It's just changed so much in the last 30 to 40 years that right now we're in a condition where you can take any species of animal.
We just have a few moments left. Casey, hit us with the cause of the problems.
Okay, real fast. You take any species of animal, deprive them of food, put them in an overcrowded area, deprive them of all comforts, and eventually gotcha. They begin to devour each other.
Casey, I gotcha. Ganesh, we keep hearing complaints about unruly passengers. Casey says, well, it's the overcrowding and the poor service that the system has set up for us.
This is one of the real challenges of the system we have now is, you know, when we don't regulate these things, we have this race to the bottom in the quality of service. And that has real downsides. Downsides for flight attendants, for other passengers, for the experience, for everyone. And, you know, that's part of the reason why we need to change things up.
Thanks for that call. And let's spend our last few minutes talking about the kind of changes you'd like to see, Ganesh. I don't know if we would go exactly to the system of regulation we had before, but what kind of starting points would you like to see?
Well, I have three principles, and I think there are a lot of ways we can achieve these. The first is no more flyover country. We should have a country where there's service to lots of different places. And one way we could do that is a kind of NFL-style draft, where there are a set of cities, and the biggest airlines each have to pick cities from the list and serve them at affordable rates with some reasonable frequency. The second principle is no bailouts, no bankruptcies. I actually want there to be a reliable, stable, profitable airline industry, and I think we should all want that because it is an essential service. And one way we could move in that direction is requiring airlines to have crisis management plans so that if there is a big shock like COVID-19 again, they're ready and know what they're going to do for 6 months or a year, and maybe have a rainy day fund as a requirement too, so that we don't have to have taxpayer support programs come in. And then the third principle is fair and transparent pricing. We need to have a much simpler system than we currently have on pricing, where the prices can change based on the day of the week when you buy the tickets. And I think if we were to do things in all three of these areas, what we would see is that together they would really shift incentives even on things like the experience inside the airplane too. And that the combination of those things would create a structure that works very differently than the one we have right now.
And just our last minute or so, Ganesh, government regulation became a dirty phrase around the time we're talking about, 70s and 80s. Do you think there would be an appetite for the people who would have to make these decisions, including in Congress, to make these changes?
Well, I think this is one of the places where there should really be a lot of bipartisan support. And the reason why is pretty simple. There are people all over this country who fly in every state and every congressional district from all different kinds of perspectives. And, you know, one thing that I've heard from our callers today and across the board is people aren't happy about this. And that's a lot of voters who, if we all call our Congress people and tell them to act, you know, hopefully we can create the pressure to get the kind of change we need.
Ganesh, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me.
Ganesh Sitaraman is a professor of law at Vanderbilt University, director of the Vanderbilt Policy Accelerator, and we've been talking about his new book. It's called Why Flying is Miserable and How to Fix It. It looks at the history of airline policy in the United States, proposes solutions for making flying a better experience for everyone. You can keep sharing your thoughts, maybe your experiences, for better or worse, with air travel. Head over to the Ideas Network Facebook page, or you can email ideas@wpr.org. I'm Rob Ferret. Stick around. There's more to come on Central Time here on the Ideas Network. Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. It's been 2 years since President Biden signed the $1 trillion bipartisan infrastructure bill into law. Wisconsin has received $5.6 billion of that funding to fix roads and bridges and also to improve access to broadband and clean water, renovate airports, and more. How is that funding being used in Wisconsin 2 years down the road? Tammy Baldwin has represented Wisconsin in the U.S. Senate since 2013. I talked to Senator Baldwin yesterday about new projects in our state that are funded by the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Now, you've been talking the last couple of days about the anniversary of this bipartisan infrastructure bill. What kind of things are we starting to see in Wisconsin as a result of that bill?
Well, as you know, when we were working on the bipartisan infrastructure law, we were defining infrastructure quite broadly. Certainly, it includes things like roads and bridges and transit, but it also included an investment in our water infrastructure, as well as the build out of our access to high speed broadband, with the goal that we would have every household, every business in Wisconsin connected to high-speed broadband as the bill is fully implemented. So when I look back over the last 2 years, simply put, this bill is working and it's making a difference in the lives of Wisconsinites. From a business who now has high-speed internet to a household or a school that has safe and clean drinking water, these investments are making our communities safer and people healthier and our economy stronger.
Before we look at some specific projects, there was some concern that from some critics of the legislation on the Republican side that this stretched the concept of infrastructure. They wanted to see more focus on, you know, the roads and the bridges and some of those things they thought might be better tackled elsewhere. Can you make the case for that slightly more expansive vision of infrastructure?
Absolutely. You know, the idea that when you turn on the faucet at your home, that you are getting safe and clean drinking water is critical. It's absolutely critical. And we still have many areas of the state where there are lead pipes in the water systems, and therefore the potential for contamination. We also have places in Wisconsin where there's PFAS contamination, where there's farm runoff and other things that are dangerous in our drinking water system. And so I'm very proud that we had a broad view with regard to investing in water infrastructure, as well as, you know, the traditional transportation infrastructure we think about. And then, you know, broadband is perhaps one that was most critiqued by opponents of moving forward with a big infrastructure investment. But boy, if the pandemic taught us nothing else, it's that we really need access to high-speed internet services to be a part of a 21st century economy. And whether that was people relying on the internet for work, for telehealth, for school, people really needed access to high-speed internet, and those who didn't have it really suffered. And so I'm really proud of the investments and having this broad vision of what a 21st century infrastructure looks like, especially after so many years and decades of neglect.
On the other hand, there were concerns from climate advocates that the infrastructure bill didn't do enough to try to bring down carbon emissions. What would you say to that? Was there some stuff there? Are there other things you've seen in subsequent legislation that might answer those concerns?
Yeah, so it's such a great question, because the infrastructure law began to lay a foundation for clean transportation. And so we had a commitment to electric vehicle charging so that we could have a network of EV chargers across the state and, frankly, across the interstate system. There was an investment in public transit, which takes more cars off the roads, and clean buses to help communities transition from combustion engine buses to electric buses. So it laid a foundation. But since that time, we have passed the Inflation Reduction Act. And in the Inflation Reduction Act, we've made the single biggest investment in transition to a clean and renewable energy sector than we've ever made, or that any country has ever made. The projection is that by 2030, we will have reduced our carbon emissions by 40% because of the investments made in the Inflation Reduction Act. That's not enough, but it's a start, and it's the boldest start of any country so far.
Let's dig into what a lot of people think of when they think of infrastructure, the roads and bridges. Now, coming through a Wisconsin summer, we're used to seeing construction. We might not connect the dots to legislation passed a couple years back. What kind of projects are we funding here in Wisconsin using this infrastructure legislation from a couple years ago?
Well, again, so many things, but I know that as I travel the state a lot. I crisscross the state to try to see my constituents where they're at. And I do see a lot of major construction projects that I know are being funded by the bipartisan infrastructure law. In my hometown of Madison, we have an extensive project underway right now relating to bus rapid transit. And we see a lot of our major thoroughfares in this city being upgraded. We know later this year or early next year, funding for six bridges in the John Nolan Drive stretch that construction will be underway, because those bridges see 40,000 cars a day, and they are deemed overdue for reinforcement. So those are the type of things we're seeing. We are applying for, and I hope to hear in the near future that we will be able to get bridge funding, significant bridge funding to address a very significant bridge that connects the city of Superior with the city of Duluth in northwestern Wisconsin, a bridge that is 60 years old and long overdue for reconstruction. So those are the sort of things that you're seeing all over. You know, one of the things you don't see as easily is the broadband infrastructure, because you know, when somebody goes from having dial-up service to having just high-speed access, that often happens within the within somebody's home or within somebody's business. But that's making a huge difference, even though it's not as visible to the public as a major highway or road construction project.
Talking to U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin, looking at the two-year anniversary of the bipartisan infrastructure bill and the impact it's had on Wisconsin. Turning to today's news, Senator Baldwin, we saw the House, the U.S. House, pass a continuing resolution for government funding. A different sort of model here, kind of dividing the budget into two different parts with different expiration dates. What do you think of that approach that's come from your colleagues over in the House?
Well, it's very non-traditional, but I think it's acceptable to those of us in the Senate, especially those of us like I have the privilege of serving on the Senate Appropriations Committee, where we have put forward all of our bills funding the various departments of government. All of our bills have passed through committee on very strong bipartisan bases. And the first four measures that the House continuing resolution contains are things that I think we can make progress on by the deadline and hopefully avert another threat of a shutdown in mid-January. So I think that there's wide support for passing this continuing resolution as it comes over from the House of Representatives and getting on with our business of passing the appropriation bills that that fund the departments of government.
Briefly, I want to talk to you about collegiality in both chambers of Congress. We saw two pieces of news yesterday, one from each chamber, a shoving incident between two Republican colleagues in the House, and then an apparent challenge to a fight from a sitting U.S. senator or one of your Republican colleagues aimed at someone testifying there. Do you have hopes that things can dial back from the level of apparent physical confrontation?
Yeah, this was it was very shocking. I was three seats away from the senator in question when he stood up to threaten a witness at one of our hearings. And I really think that it's frankly incumbent upon the Senate Republican leadership to to intervene and make it absolutely clear that this is unacceptable for a sitting senator. It's at a time when there's so many divisions in our country, we need to have members of the Congress, members of the Senate, being role models of how to work together and get things done. And this was just the opposite and very, very unseemly.
Senator Baldwin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Wisconsin's U.S. Senator Tammy Baldwin. I talked to her yesterday about how Wisconsin is using its share of funding on the second anniversary of the bipartisan infrastructure bill. Up next, a congressional reporter shares the latest on the stopgap funding measure that pushes a shutdown deadline back to 2024. That's up next here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Late Wednesday night, Congress passed a stopgap spending measure, narrowly avoiding a government shutdown, which is going to happen this weekend if lawmakers failed to take action. The deadline for settling the federal budget has been pushed back to early 2024, when the House and Senate will have to settle their differences again. House Speaker Mike Johnson, who put the plan forward, said he will no longer support stopgap funding measures after this, since he says they just delay an inevitable fight with the Senate. We're taking a look at the stopgap measure that'll keep the government funded through early next year and how we got there. You can join in at 800-642-1234. What do you want to know about the risk of government shutdown? Why do you think Congress keeps getting to the brink? Do you want to see changes in how they do this stuff? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Ginger Gibson is Senior Washington Editor for NBC News Digital. Ginger, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks for having me back.
Ginger, we have this sort of two-tiered stopgap spending bill. It's a little different than what we usually see coming out of these. What did we end up with this time?
This time we ended up with really the United States Congress saying that they didn't have any fight left in them. It was only weeks ago when we thought that they might be on the brink of a shutdown. At the end of September, the start of October, they seemed to surprise us all at the last minute and pass that funding bill, that ultimately prompted the removal of Kevin McCarthy. And so they've spent the intervening weeks, the last 6 weeks, fighting more amongst themselves and trying to figure out how to keep the government funded. And that sort of culminated in this week, where they said that they would extend the government funding, pass Christmas, assure that they all can go home and have the holidays. And as you mentioned in your last segment with the senator, it really seems on Capitol Hill today like they need that break because the tensions are high and nerves are frayed.
Now, Speaker Johnson managed to shepherd this through with Democratic support, and it looks like so far he's not going to be immediately ousted as his predecessor, Speaker McCarthy, was. Does that mean he has better blood with his caucus? Is it just they're tired of deciding who their leader is going to be? Why did he get a pass, at least for now?
I think it's a little bit of everything, right? They don't have the ill will towards Johnson that they had towards Kevin McCarthy. So some of the removal was bad blood between McCarthy and his detractors. That started from the day he was sworn in, and they were sort of looking for a last straw to sort of make them pull the trigger to remove him. So he doesn't have that bad blood. I think some of it's exhaustion. I think some of it is having watched what happens when you put up that fight and seeing the fallout maybe gave them less of an appetite for it. There's still a lot of open questions about what the political ramifications for Republicans are for the past 6 weeks. We can only hypothesize now, but there's a lot of hypothesizing going on Capitol Hill and a lot of questions left to be answered about whether or not they could pay some political price for really looking chaotic these last several weeks. And so I think Republicans, fearing that may be the case as well, has started to say maybe not another round of this if our voters aren't so thrilled about it.
Let's bring on a caller. Mark is with us in New Berlin. Mark, hi.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I'm a senior citizen. I've been retired for 10 years, and I can't believe this government keeps spending $1 trillion a year more than it brings in. How we can't do this forever. Don't people realize that? We're turning into a third world country. We won't be able to pay our debts. We won't be able to pay our commitments. And we're not going to be able to maintain our military.
Mark, thanks for the call. And Ginger, some Republicans on Capitol Hill are echoing Mark's argument and saying, you know, it may not be ideal, but let's use these risks of shutdown and these budget stopgaps here. Let's use this for leverage for spending cuts. I assume that many Republicans are still arguing along those lines. Is that right?
That's right. I think Mark would find a lot of like-minded Republicans on Capitol Hill. I think the problem that Mark would find is that if he asked them afterwards what they planned to cut or what they wanted to cut or where they were going to make those reductions, they'd have a hard time finding answers. Lots of folks on Capitol Hill say deficit spending is not sustainable, that it is a national security risk to continue to spend at debt levels, but they just aren't willing to make the cuts. you know, Mark is retired. Is he worried about raising the retirement age? Is he worried about cutting Social Security benefits? Has less impact on him, but it does have an impact. And so those are the kind of places, would Mark support really scaling back defense spending, shrinking the size of the Pentagon? I think that there are some people who would, but not everyone. And those are really hard things to figure out. And so the easy part is saying, let's shut down the government to try to force cuts. The hard part is finding cuts that you can get through both chambers of Congress.
Thanks a lot for that call, Mark. Ginger, over the years, we've seen, you know, bipartisan groups of members of Congress get together and try to come up with longer-term budget plans, try to come up with longer-term spending cuts. They, in some cases, get to the point of releasing a plan, and then, as you say, there's a lot of disagreement about it, and nothing happens. Are people talking along those lines, trying to come up with some kind of grand bargain again?
I mean, there are discussions. We all remember sequestration. Maybe we don't all remember, because maybe we blocked it out, or you don't want to remember. But there was a period of time in the last decade where Congress tried to force cuts. They tried to cap spending, tying domestic spending to defense spending. This CR that was passed this week is going to extend spending for some parts of the government through like January 19th and the rest of it into February. And that is also sort of an idea to try to force some conversations, force some discussions. But it's really a difficult time, I think, to do that, because at its core, Congress is really more polarized than they've ever been. I think we might not understand for a long time how much January 6th really divided their ability to come together. And it just doesn't seem on Capitol Hill at this point that there is an appetite or a climate to reach those type of grand bargains. And it's going to take a lot of work, and it's going to take a lot of time. And at this point, no one has really started doing that hard work that I think would take to get the kind of bipartisan agreement you would need, particularly if one side, Republicans, say that raising taxes is completely off the table. I think that that would be a real sticking point for Democrats, and a place where they would have a hard time getting past.
Talking to Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor for NBC News Digital, about the latest averted government shutdown and the latest stopgap measure on the federal budget. Back to your calls. James is with us in Milwaukee. James, hello.
Hello. There's one thing that I'd like to point out, and this has been true since the so-called contract with America back in 94. That was made by Newt Gingrich and the Republican Party. Time and again, the government has been shut down, and we've gone to the brink over and over as far as passing budgets. And this just isn't healthy for the United States.
James, I gotcha. Thanks for the call. We've seen, Ginger, some of those organizations that rate credit ratings nudge the U.S. credit rating down a bit, largely because of the shutdowns or near misses that James is talking about. In our last minute, consequences of running our budget this way.
I mean, there's going to be consequences for a long time, and I think we don't even fully understand what those consequences are going to be. How does it affect future policymaking? How does it affect future tax levels? What does it do to our ability to borrow? But also, I think it's important to think about the mindset that it has created. I mentioned earlier raising taxes. There's such a hard line against raising taxes, even in the wake of the ability to cut taxes, or the having cut taxes, that it's really just made it the way it always was. And that starts changing the way we think about our spending and our taxation levels, and really changes our country. And so there's long-term ramifications for this that I think we are still far away from understanding.
Ginger, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us today. We've been talking to Ginger Gibson, senior Washington editor at NBC News Digital. She talked to us today about the stopgap spending measure that will at least temporarily fund the government. That goes through early 2024, when we'll be likely talking about this again. You can share your thoughts still. Email ideas@WPR.org. That's ideas@WPR.org. Coming up tomorrow on The Morning Show with Kate Archer Kent, a play running now here in Wisconsin tackles issues of life after incarceration. Get a preview and dig into the issues raised in that play. That's coming up tomorrow morning at 8 here on the Ideas Network. If you ever go out to look at art at a museum or gallery or sculpture garden, you may find things you like to look at, even if you don't know why you like them. So what's going on in your mind at that moment? We may never know, but a new project may find out what's going on in your brain. As reported in Smithsonian Magazine, a new project at a gallery in London has gallery visitors wear a headset with an electroencephalogram, or EEG, brain monitor. The EEG readings then appear on a screen to show the brain's activity while the visitor is looking at different pieces of art. It doesn't show what the whole brain is doing, just a piece of the puzzle called beta waves. The beta waves are represented by a ribbon pattern, according to a statement from the gallery. When a user is more alert, the ribbons become wider. When they're trying to make sense of something confusing, the ribbons start to spiral and weave. When the viewer sees something they recognize, bright highlights appear. In short, this is your brain, and this is your brain on art. Any questions? This is Central Time.